Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Kathy Borey. She is an author and speaker who works tirelessly as an advocate for people with Alzheimer's and their caregivers. Kathy and I will be discussing about her memoir titled The Long Hello. Good morning, Kathy. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Oh, very well, Johnny. I'm just so honored to be on your show. I love the title of your book and your show, and I know you do a lot of good work. So thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. The Long Hello is a wonderful labor of love book. It is a beautifully written memoir, so congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. Those are kind words. Thank you.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
In 5 seconds or less?
We have the whole hours.
That's a tough question, but yes, I think I can summarize it because I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. In order to write a memoir, you have to think about your life. So
yes.
I certainly spent a lot of time doing that. I am Canadian. I'm in Vancouver right now, and I was born here. And I was born in the early 50s, so my parents, of course, would have, and all my older family would have been through the war, which is were very, you know, tricky times. I had a brother and who later died rather tragically in his teens. And my mother and father were divorced, which was very unusual in those days. Nobody really got divorced. I think we were the only kids of divorced parents. But my father, very sadly, had a drinking problem and it became untenable. So we moved in with my grandparents, which many of your listeners will identify with, was a wonderful time for us. It was out in the country and those were days when one was more free to roam on bike and foot. Mm-hmm. And I had the benefit of adoring grandparents to look after me as well as my mom who had to go back to work. So those were pretty good times. My mother remarried. She married a much older man, but very fit, very avid businessman. So he traveled a lot, and because of that, I went to boarding school, which were not really very happy years. But in hindsight, again, from writing the memoir, I looked back more reasonably, really, more logically, and the insight I gained was probably it was better to be at boarding school than, you know, at home where my parents were traveling a lot. So interesting insights to be gained from sitting and thinking and writing. After high school, I dabbled in theater but didn't quite make the grade, Johnny. I loved to perform, but I just didn't figure that was for me, and I think that was the right decision. I went into nursing school, which in those days was based still in hospitals, so it was quite disciplined. We had to live in residence, we had to wear uniforms and curfews, and I again, looking back, realized that I was just repeating my boarding school experience, so I was really comfortable in that environment, and I guess I sought that out. I then went on to work for a few years in nursing, but I wasn't really, I don't think it was a good fit for me. I found myself perhaps a little bit too involved, and I went on to do further education. I actually came down to the States and did my master's in public health at Johns Hopkins, which was a wonderful year, probably one of the best I've ever had. And I came back and worked in the Arctic in health administration and also went on to do a law degree, more to really augment my background. And I didn't want to practice law. I couldn't see myself in a three-piece black suit sitting in an office with a nice briefcase all day. So I didn't do that, but I combined it with my health, and I did a little bit of retail and had a very challenging and good, rich life. And then I'm being very quick about this, but then I went on. That's when, after that time, I guess I was in my 40s, when my mom got sick. Or 50s, I guess it would be. I lose track of the decades. So, yeah. So I have had a very rich and challenging and interesting time of it.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
when I was writing the memoir, I went through all those sort of stories and brought
mm-hmm.
those out in context.
When you're young at heart, you always lose track of the numbers.
Oh, is that right? And I'm glad you say that. Really, I'm going to use that line.
It works for me.
Well, I like that very much, and I think you might be right, because perhaps if one's not so, you know, busy and interested and young at heart, as you say, then the years are easier to remember. But if you're sort of doing many different things at different times, it would be harder to remember them.
Right, right. You always have to come up with something as a comeback.
Well, I'm going to plagiarize you and take that line, because I
no
need
problem.
That line.
Be my guest. Be my guest.
Thank you.
What is dementia?
Well, dementia is really an umbrella term for a variety of brain disorders. So, for example, when you think of something like cancer, it's an umbrella term for cancers, and then there's all these different cancers
right.
within that group, like breast cancer or brain cancer. So dementia, that's a good way to think about it. So there's many causes of dementia. Could be brain injury, could be Alzheimer's, which takes up 65%, could be strokes. And basically, the symptoms are very clear. There's loss of memory, judgment, and reasoning. And also you see changes in mood and behavior. So it's sort of that's really what it is. Catch-all term for different disorders, yes.
Your mom, she had a low Parkinson as well as Alzheimer's, correct?
She did. And apparently, I mean, I don't look into all those. I never did look into all the facts clinically all that strongly. But apparently there are a certain percentage of people that have those two diseases at the same time, which is rather extraordinary when you think about it. But she did.
Mm-hmm.
She had both.
Do you have the latest facts and figures that you can share with us regarding this debilitating disease?
I have a few. I'll tell you what I know as of now. Basically, in the United States, you're going to look at about 5 million people who have Alzheimer's, and worldwide, 35 million. What's really interesting, and where maybe the numbers become a little bit more meaningful, is that those numbers are expected to double every 20 years.
Wow.
And of course, part of the reason, because we're growing older, and so you're going to see a lot more, as you know, a lot more incidence of that disease because the numbers are rising. And the other thing, of course, is when we think about statistics, we think of the number of caregivers that are looking after those people. So I think the general idea with statistics is that it's not going away soon.
As the generation ages, this is the number one health issue that the generation is facing right now, the older generation is facing.
No, it's a very good point, Johnny. You're quite right. I think that's what's on everybody's mind, and because there's so many of us, and that's what we think about all the time. You know, I think we used to think about things like cancer and heart attacks and stroke, and I'm sure we still do, but I think most people that you would run into on the street or talk to, that would be something that they'd be more worried about than anything else. And I also think that their children would be worried because they know they're going to be caregivers.
Right, right.
You know,
very true.
Yeah.
How much did you know about the disease prior to your mom's case?
Well, you know, when I went through nursing school, I worked on the medical ward and looked out in, you know, geriatric ward and looked after older people, which I loved a lot. But we used to call it senility. And it was just sort of a normal course of things that a certain group of people, when they got old, would become, as we used to call it, senile.
Right.
So I knew, I had that experience, and I guess many people would have had it with their grandparents and different relatives. I didn't really know a lot about Alzheimer's because, of course, I'd been out of the health field for decades, and I think the surge in information was just beginning, and so I didn't really know that much about it, to be honest with you.
Interesting. What were your first reaction and thoughts when you found out about your mom's situation?
Well, I can remember it because we were in her doctor's office. She had a lovely doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And she she told me on, you know, on my own, because Mom had, as you pointed out, had Parkinson's as well, and a certain group of people with Parkinson's have dementia. And so she knew that her mind was changing because of the Parkinson's. And so her doctor, you know, took me in and was talking, because Alzheimer's is sort of a probable diagnosis, right? They're never really 100% sure, but they have good guesses. And I must say I was, you know, pretty, I think I sort of felt my spine grow cold. I was not shocked because I'd seen the symptoms, but I must say I was pretty worried. I thought, oh my gosh, you know, what does this mean and what is going to happen? I was pretty scared.
Was there a time when you were thinking that this might be something hereditary in some ways as well?
You know, I didn't think much about it. I think the statistics on genetics on late onset Alzheimer's, where people are old when they get it, my chances as a child are more than if I didn't have a parent, but they're not huge. So I didn't dwell on it. I don't see the point. I don't see the point. No, I really don't.
Were there books at that time as well as support groups to help you adjust yourself to embrace the new experience?
Yes, there were. All the Alzheimer's societies around the world run support groups, and they do a very good job at it. And those groups, I think, and associations are getting stronger and stronger at doing that. I did try one group, not with the Alzheimer's Association, but another group, and it was very negative and depressing, so I didn't go back. And that can happen. And, you know, my family and myself as well, another thing I learned through my memoir, certainly was illustrated, was, you know, that we're quite a private family. So for me, individually, to go out and share things with a group is not really my thing. It is lots of people's things, and very, very helpful, but not so much for me. I also, Johnny, interestingly enough, found the books on the market quite depressing and dry. And you know, I'm not interested in being told what to expect in a dry, matter-of-fact kind of educational way. It just doesn't appeal to me. I love fiction. I love stories. And so nothing... I have to say nothing really helped. The one thing I did that was very helpful was that I got in contact with a woman who was an educator, a professor at university here and had retired, and her whole area of her career for study was middle-aged people looking after their elderly parents, which, of course, is what I was doing. And in addition to that, she had a family therapy certificate. So I went to see her with the prime purpose of trying to learn how better to cope. And that was very, very helpful. So I didn't go to sort of talk about my troubles, and she understood that. I went to tell her what was going on and try to get better at dealing with things. So that was very, very helpful. I was lucky to find the right person.
One person in the equation has to be uplifting, because obviously the person who is suffering from that can sort of dwindle down very quickly in the negative energy around her if you're not careful about that. And obviously in this case, for you, you have to be uplifting. And then you're right, because different people have different personality. Some people enjoy being marinated in the same energy as the situation, and some people, on the other hand, want to have a fresh new perspective, a new twist, to whereby, hey, you know, what can we do about it, and how do we show up, I guess, in some ways to assist in our own special way or based on our own personality and our own style.
That's very perceptive. I really like your use of the word marinated. That's really very good. I love that. That's true. You can choose one side or the other.
Yeah,
marinate yourself in sorrow or marinate yourself in something more positive.
Right. Why did you decide to be your mom's caregiver?
Well, I was the only child left, for one thing, and my mother and I had always been very close. I loved her very dearly, and it was not even a decision to make. I was fortunate enough financially to be able to do that, although I worked part-time during quite a bit of her illness. But we were fortunate to have that time that I could do that. But for me, it was a very deep sort of... I couldn't not take care of her, if you understand my meaning. She was important to
certainly.
Me, and I felt that's what you do. You do take care of people you love, and actually you take care of people you don't love, too.
Right.
So it was never a question for me.
Right. Interesting. How did you manage to get yourself organized and be prepared for this new lifestyle?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't know. I don't think you can. It's so unpredictable, Johnny. You don't really know what's going to happen. Even if you're well versed in the disease and the symptoms, mm-hmm. every individual is different, and you don't know what's going to happen from minute to minute. So I can't say I did a very good job, or even if I could have done a good job at knowing how to get myself prepared for this. I think it was more trying to get the hardest part is trying to get into a place to almost be unprepared, just to be accepting in the moment kind of thing of accepting what's coming next.
You're obviously a learned person based on the formal education you have, and I guess in life, basically, we live and we experience life and we accumulate knowledge and wisdom. Were there life experiences you drew from to assist you along the way?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm sure that to some extent my nursing, even though it was limited to 3 to 5 years, would have helped me learn things like advocacy, how to make sure that when we went to the doctor, things got heard, and not be intimidated by the healthcare system, which is very intimidating, and how to work that system. I think that helped me help my mother, for sure. Mm-hmm. Life experiences, I think, sounds sort of simple, but I think I learned from my family and maybe even from nursing, but more from family, just how to provide very simple comfort measures and how to remember things that my mother loved, like music and mm-hmm. babies and things like that. Just life experience of listening to what other people value. I think those helped me then bring those things into her life when she became ill were quite important.
Basically, it's the practical application of the things that you have encountered with your mom during the yesteryears that you brought into the equation.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What incidents and encounters were the most challenging for you as a caregiver for your mom?
Well, let's see. I think being so solitary was really tricky because we mm-hmm. had no other family, not close nuclear family. We had some mm-hmm. family that turned up to not really help out, but to stay in touch.
Yeah.
Others fell away, which is very common. And, of course, being a much older woman, many of her friends had already passed away, which is common, of course, and predictable.
Right.
So I found that very, very difficult. I found that having left my life of committees or boards and groups and challenges and all that was gone. I had no cohort anymore. And I think that was extremely difficult for me to move into this life, which was absolutely opposite to what I've been living. That was very, very challenging. I think mm-hmm. those things were the most difficult for me.
Why write the long hello?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. What happened was, as I started to sort of settle down into the experience, and I wasn't always successful mm-hmm. at that, but when I did, and listened to my mother instead of interrupting her and correcting her and reorienting her, when I kind of got more into that Zen space, I heard a voice emerging in her that I was absolutely not expecting, and it was insightful and very funny and mm-hmm. had a poetic sensibility to it, and it was shocking. It was so gorgeous, and the more I heard it, I started to sort of jot things down,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
then as I started to jot these things down, I started to jot things down about our whole lives as much as I could about her life and my own, which seemed to have a relevance.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I found that there were things there that were so interesting that I wasn't expecting, that I thought there's a story here that we don't hear.
Mm-hmm.
In the literature and in groups and things like that, we don't hear those stories. And I thought there's a valuable story here that should be heard.
A lot of times our relationship with our loved ones tend to be in the past and in the future, never in the present moment.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, and in reading your book, what got to me was, interestingly enough, you were evolving. We all travel. I mean, life is a journey. And as we all travel to this time, you slowly but surely, based on what you've written, you're taking moments to recapture the wonderful things that you have encountered with your mom over the years. You have a different sense of appreciation, a fresh new perspective at looking at things. And then, of course, in her situation, medical situation, she is able to innocently say things as is.
That's right.
So I thought that was very interesting. If I may share something, a recipe for living from one of my moms, this is kind of ironic about the whole situation in reading this. I just spoke with my Cajun mom yesterday, and she was diagnosed with dementia.
And oh, my.
Yes, in speaking to her, one of the things that she told me that I've treasured so much is, Farrell, what you have garnered over the years that you have spent with your mom during the caregiving time is that the natural life can always be funny and humorous. The most ordinary events usually ends up being the sweetest memories. Being present during the small moments will always make us appreciate happiness when it happens.
Oh boy, I'll second that. That's beautifully said as well. You're quite right. You're absolutely right. And so the trick is how to stay present for those small moments of beauty, poetic beauty, and just to really be aware of them and have a consciousness of them, because those are going to sustain you as you go through.
Yes, very much so. What were the toughest things to write in the book?
Well, that's quite easy for me to recall. I think that the toughest things to write in the book were, well, two things. One was when there were particular moments of her suffering, because of course she suffered.
Right.
And they were when she didn't know where her mother and father were. And I found that very upsetting, very upsetting. Mm-hmm. And of course I wrote about it. So when I wrote about it, it was upsetting again. Not as upsetting as having lived through it, but to recall it was very upsetting. But one must be honest when one's writing a book and go through that. I found that heartbreaking because I loved my grandparents and she wanted to be with them, so that was heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And the second thing that was really hard to write about was the loss of my brother, which is a theme throughout the whole book, really.
Right, right.
And it's a major story of the book. And so that was very difficult to write about as well. But it's doable. I mean, my little philosophy in my head was, if I could live it, I can write about it. If I lived it and got through, then I can put those words on the page.
Right.
And I've even had people write to me that have nothing to do with Alzheimer's but connect with the other stories of the book. Maybe it's divorce or the loss of a sibling or boarding school, and say, you know, thank you because you wrote about this so honestly that I could identify with what you said, and I feel better for it. So those were the two things that were tricky. And of course, Johnny, the thing is that I had to edit it like 100 times. So, you know, and sometimes I wouldn't have the strength. And I mean, even now sometimes when I'm going through my book, I don't read those pieces that when I do performances, I can't do it. But even going through the book and the manuscript when I was editing it, I would, it was quite weird. It was like I was a six-year-old child and looked away from something I didn't want to see. So I'd take those chapters and I wouldn't look at the pages. I'd just quickly rifle through them until I got to the next chapter. You know, one can only take so much.
Right, right. It's true. One of the compelling things I think we all go through, in the sense that there is an underlying factor here. We don't say it as much. Of course, our parents, some of our parents, tend to do this very, very well in terms of loving all of us. Of course, you love your loved ones unconditionally. So there's tremendous amount of unconditional love flowing back and forth from parent, child, child, parent situation. But having said that, the thing that I got reading your book, and you mentioned that, because the immediate reaction that you have is that you felt guilty not being able to spend every moment of the time with your mom. And then if you're not able to see your mom, that's a guilt factor. Oh my gosh, I mean, is she going to forget me? What happens if something triggers her and she don't remember me anymore? And the last captured moments that she has of me is because I was not able to be there with her. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's interesting. My I mean, I saw her so much it wasn't funny because I was obsessed with looking after her. But you're quite right. If I, you know, we were lucky enough to have a live-in caregiver, so she didn't have to go to an institution, which was basically, she lived 5 minutes away from me. And so I would go home at night most of the time, and I felt guilty about leaving and guilty about going to sleep and, you know, guilty until I got over there to look after her. So you're quite right. But my guilt was more structured around, is she okay? Is she being looked after properly? Is she lonely?
Right.
Lonely is, you know, a big theme.
Right.
Because I always felt I could take care of those things. And so my guilt was surrounded about that. Interestingly enough, and I'm glad you brought this up, the focus on people and their anxiety about not being remembered for who they are is very, very interesting. And I know there are many people, and I've heard this, who completely freak out when their family doesn't remember who they are anymore.
Right, right.
And sometimes people will not even go visit their family in homes because they say, why should I? They don't know who I am, and or
right.
they won't remember, which, of course, to me is totally, absolutely horrifying.
Right.
And because the focus is on self and ego rather than on other.
Right.
If you go to visit somebody that doesn't know you, you just have a whole new relationship with them.
That's right.
I remember that I went over to my mom's once. I had to have my hip replaced because I danced my hip into the floor with the tango and the foxtrot, which I know we're going to be talking about. And I had to pretend I was in England, and then I went at a dance competition. When I went to see her, when I could get going over there in crutches, it was the first time she didn't know who I was. And, of course, I was already feeling pretty vulnerable with all that I had been through, and I was very upset. But it was the last time I was upset because I realized that, really, we could start a whole new story together. And often she thought I was her brother, my beloved uncle, whom I knew very well and loved. Mm-hmm. So I just pretended I was him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was pretty cool. So it really depends on perspective, but the main thing is that there's no excuse for not being with people just because they don't remember you, because you've had a whole lifetime to be known.
Right.
And
right.
sometimes that ends. I mean, think about it. If you had a sibling or a child or someone that was in an accident and had a brain injury and they didn't know who you were, would you not go see them anymore? Well, of course you would.
Right.
So you
right.
just reestablish whatever that connection is can be quite fictional, and you just have a chance to become a whole new person, Johnny, maybe a better person. maybe you got a chance to do better as this new character. So
right.
it's interesting, but the guilt part is very tricky to deal with. I didn't really get my head around that very well.
Right. Well, it's true. On the lighter side, let's put it this way. Mom don't remember all the nasty things you used to do, so hooray. But
you can be the new best child.
That's right. But on a serious note, I happened to hear a story about a chairman of the board that actually gave up his chairmanship to be with his wife, who was suffering from Alzheimer's. What's very interesting is, like what you had just mentioned just now, the board members and everyone else had mentioned to him, saying that, why are you doing this? She don't even remember you. And here is a perfect gentleman that said something that to me is very, very profound, and it should be something that we all need to think about. It is true that she does not know me, but you know what? I know her.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Yeah.
And I thought that's what unconditional love is all about.
Right. Yeah, that's so beautiful. And, gosh, I'm so glad you said that, because I think it's very important for people to hear that, because then it puts the onus on oneself to continue to do the right thing out of love.
Right, right, right. And so that makes a big difference. And one of the things that you did I thought was very nice was the fact that you started recording things for your mom so that she could listen to your voice.
Oh, I'm so glad that you brought that up. You know what happened? We were in a cafe. We used to go to the same restaurant for lunch whenever we could, and it was, of course, quite depressing for me. But and when I was interested, of course, in my own sorrow, but it was a little bit kind of dismal. But we had a wonderful server that loved Mom, and that was really good. But we were sitting there one day, and no one's going to believe this, but of course I had had my heart terribly broken by a young man, or maybe not so young, and I was feeling very depressed, and I went to sit with Mom, and I would have used her insight for counsel over the years on many occasions. We had that kind of a rapport as well, and I always respected what she had to say. But yeah. Because her mind had been changing, I thought, oh my goodness, maybe I shouldn't bring this up. Maybe it's, maybe it would not be understandable to her, or too taxing, or even upsetting, and maybe I should not be selfish and bring it up. But I was so upset that I just said to her, Mom, what do you do if you love someone but he doesn't love you? And without skipping a beat, she just looked at me and said, go find someone else. And it was so funny. And I thought, oh, we're on a roll. So I said, well, what is love?
Yeah.
And she says, well, it's the sublime between two people in the same working order. And Johnny, when I heard that, I thought, my goodness, that is love. She never would have said that without her mind changing. And I wrote it down. I've still got the white serviette where I've got it coffee stained and written down. And that's when I thought, boy, is this person worth listening to? I will never be able to write fast enough and remember what she said. That's when I started recording. Thank goodness, because I wouldn't have a book. I wouldn't have all those wonderful lines that that are priceless. Mm-hmm. And that are, of course, as running all through the Long Hello, verbatim. Mm-hmm. And and I have her singing, and it's just fantastic. So that's why I started recording. I highly recommend it. It also, Johnny, interestingly enough, gave us both something to do. She was honored that I was taping her. Who wouldn't be? Who wants to tape you? Nobody.
Right.
Secondly, I had something to do. So it passed the time very nicely.
Right. What I got from the book, which I'm so glad in terms of recording wonderful moments that you share with your mom, is people don't realize it. It's funny because we talk about this all the time. We live in the past, we live in the future, and sometimes we live in the present. And then when we lose loved ones, then we realize, I wish I had that, I wish I had this, or I wish I had so-and-so and so forth. But if we were to take moments, it's true that we can be with that person 24/7, but at wonderful moments, for example, family gatherings and whatnot. And of course, here in the United States, we have Thanksgiving coming up. And I apologize for not knowing when Thanksgiving is for Canada, but I think it's coming up fairly soon as well, if I'm not mistaken. Or maybe you all have just celebrated Thanksgiving. But my point, what I'm trying to get to, is that if we just spend that time to really have those captured moments, whether it's recorded, a photo, a video, because now we have the technology to do that. These captured moments are wonderful moments that we can look back in time and truly appreciate the wonderful moments that we share. And then if you do have children and grandchildren and so forth, that you can really share those wonderful captured moments with.
Yes, that's a really beautiful idea. And I think one of the things that I worry about most in life is regrets.
Yeah,
because I think they're so toxic. Like how do you get your head around your regrets?
Right.
So I think that's quite motivating. You think as you start your day, what are the things I've left undone? That scares me more than the things I've done that I wish I hadn't done. And you're quite right.
Right.
So
right.
With Thanksgiving coming up and different holidays, or even nothing, the whole idea of recording it and remembering, when you record something or videotape it or write about it, it becomes entrenched into your consciousness and memory more strongly. I think you're saying that. And it's an excellent idea, especially with your Thanksgiving coming up. People could use that as a vehicle to pay better attention and have those memories.
Right. And don't wait till a tragic situation arises before you start capturing those wonderful, special moments.
Absolutely. And as you said earlier in our conversation, it's those everyday, really simple things.
Right.
Sitting down to dinner, going for a walk, looking at a garden. Those are the things where beauty really can become infused when you're really paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So what else did you learn about your mom that you did not know during the 7 years?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one of the largest revelation came with mm-hmm. the things we've just been talking about in her words. The mm-hmm. way she used language and the way she thought and put an idea together was so poetic mm-hmm. that it was astonishing. Now, I remember, this is so interesting, Johnny, but I remember showing an editor some pieces of the work where they were her conversations or her words verbatim. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, well, you made that up, didn't you? She wouldn't have said that. And he wasn't accusing me. He was just trying to understand where the words came
yeah.
from.
Right.
And I said, no, I'm not clever enough to put that sentence together. Mm-hmm. And, or that idea, that insight, that other, it was like words coming from a different universe that were so sensible but extraordinary that I just had no idea that poetic beauty lay within her. And it was nothing but a source of joy to listen to her and pick those out of many other conversations that were not that way. But mm-hmm. it was a highlight, and I was... That, one of the reasons I wrote that book, to honor her, because I thought what she said was just astonishing. Mm-hmm. And I thought other people should hear that, because I've heard those stories of people with that have family with Alzheimer's that say equally extraordinary and beautiful things, but they haven't mm-hmm. written them down. But it's certainly part of the disease, Johnny. It really is. It's a gorgeous mm-hmm. part of it.
Were there things that you learned about yourself as well?
Well, yes. I suppose one of the things I learned was that I had a somewhat lyrical, poetic writer's voice in me that I didn't know I had. That was huge, actually. And I had always wanted to write, but I'd never done anything about it. Goodness me, that could have been one of those regrets. One of the things we've left undone.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, if I hadn't looked after my mom, then I wouldn't have learned that there was in me a writer, and that was fairly mm-hmm. profound. And I guess another thing that I learned that wasn't really new, but it certainly taught me a lot about myself, was that I still continued that, you know, waspish, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant family tradition of keeping silent not saying what we think. So I thought, I'm still that person. So that was revealed to me even more strongly, and of course something I'm always trying to do something about. But mm-hmm. you know, big mm-hmm. things that you learn about yourself if you're willing to, right?
Right, right. It's true. What's interesting, though, I mean, in reading your book, I noticed that you have somehow inevitably journal over the years. I mean, you kept all the correspondence, I guess I would think, in this case, because you shared some wonderful intimate letters that your mom and you had corresponded over the years. And then
right.
one of the stories that was very nicely done, and I would like you to share this story, is the correspondence you had with your headmistress. And she was at that time in a position where she was also taking care of a dear friend as well, who I believe suffered from Alzheimer's. Can you share the quote that she shared with you? I thought that little conversation that y'all have helped you in so many ways.
Yes, you know, I'm so glad you picked that out. I just love that little story. Just as a little tiny bit of background, when I was at boarding school, I had a headmistress. It was sort of out of sync with the times, with the 60s. But what she was very much in sync with is literature. And I love literature, and what she taught me about the love of words, et cetera, was fantastic. And so I wrote to her, and I said to her, all those beautiful words, you saved my life, thank you. And then she wrote me back, and I'll quote the letter, Johnny. My dear, one day when you are old, you will know how much your words mean. I'm enclosing a quote that I think you will like, but cannot find the author's name. Quote, surely the universe has by now shown us enough previously unsuspected wonders to occasionally accept, on faith, something we cannot yet explain. And then she had said something across the page, which you might be referring to, too. It is terribly sad to see someone you love fail so rapidly. There seems so little I can do except try to keep her happy in her little home, and I feel I am not always successful in doing that. So both those phrases helped me immeasurably, I'm really glad that you picked up on that.
People don't write like that anymore.
Wasn't she a beautiful writer, Johnny? What a beautiful letter.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm so glad I kept it, Johnny. It could have been one of the things I threw away.
Well, you see, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Maybe the older I get, I tend to be a little bit more sentimental about things like that. But when we get stuff like that and we don't give much weight to those things. Oh, yeah, great, nice, yeah, let me just put it somewhere, and that's it. And what happens is that you never know when those words will really connect with you and can be used to help others. I think that's the most important thing as well.
Absolutely true. And that letter, I think would help people as much as it helped me. And beautifully put together. That whole world of letter writing, which I still do, is certainly gone, but not gone, but dwindling. It's a very good thing to do because you have to articulate your thoughts, and, it's lovely.
I consider that as a wonderful journaling exercise because especially when you're in a situation where you're in, having the opportunity to express yourself on paper, that sort of lightened the load that your mind is going through. And of course, you have another outlet that you do very well, that is ballroom dancing. And I noticed that ballroom dancing truly helped you to kind of really take you away, to have that moment of playtime, to be away, to be refreshed, and then to get back, I guess, for lack of a better term, you're in the ball game again. Tell us a little bit about that.
I will. Before I get into that, I wanted to say one quick thing that you brought up about the writing being therapeutic, so it's so insightful. They've actually done studies now to show how writing is, clinically shown to be therapeutic and healing. So it's another very good reason to write down what you're going through, and even if it means taking a course or something to be part of, or be part of a group. But they've actually shown it's very therapeutic. Now, Johnny, you're bringing up one of my favorite subjects, ballroom dancing. And I think we have some of this in common. What happened was, I've always loved music, and I've always loved to move to music. But, of course, the old disco dancing in the old days, we didn't know what we were doing. We were just on the floor flailing around like mad people. But there was a bit of a craze here, and I'm sure there was in the States, with swing dancing. Mm-hmm, and I saw people, and I thought, wow, man, that looks like fun. Good exercise and just fun, fun, fun. So I went all over Vancouver to take lessons, and everything turned out badly. The teacher didn't turn up, or the group was huge, or, this sort of thing. And funnily enough, my mother says, well, why don't you try Arthur Murray? Now, Johnny, in my head, I'm thinking Lawrence Welk with the bubbles and people in, pink polyester suits. I don't know where I got that idea from, but I thought, oh, my gosh. And then she said, well, come on. So I phoned them and went down for a complimentary lesson, which, of course, they do. And that was it. I was totally hooked. The level of teaching was fantastic. And I went down to learn swing dancing, but as you know, you learn all the dances. So,
right.
Which was better for me in the long run. I never did swing again. But what was so interesting about dance for me at that time, looking after Mom, was it wasn't important for me to go and sit at the parties and chat and socialize. It was to get on the floor. And I was very interested in artistically telling stories on the floor to dances that were specially choreographed. That helped me sink down into a really deep place of learning and study and emotion. So for me, you're quite right. It was an incredible respite. And as soon as I walked through that door, I did have this transition problem. It was quite weird. I'd walk through the door and feel very, not really angry, but almost like this transitioning from my mom to this place. And luckily, I had a teacher that understood that we just wanted to get right into it, which we did. And once I got into it, it was just pure joy, just pure love of moving to music and rhythm. And it was, you know, I don't know if I could have made it through that without that that place where I could move in beauty and be
right,
so challenged
right.
to do it.
Right.
And one of the things that I think I learned there, which was a metaphor, was this whole following and leading bit. And you'll know what I'm talking about. But I learned over many years that being a woman and following had nothing to do with losing power or status, and it wasn't a place of subservience. It was a place of strength. For one reason, I know you're going to add to this, but for one reason for me was that the lesson of learning to listen with my body and my head and to wait and to wait and to wait and not to initiate, it was very tricky. And it wasn't that I wanted to lead because of status. It was that sometimes I thought, oh, I missed that lead, or I'm stupid. I shouldn't just stand here. So, but I never wanted to be in control, even though I am an alpha dog, because I don't care which way we go, but I didn't want to do the wrong thing. So that Zen state of just waiting, and it's a beautiful place. I think that that helped me learn to do the same with my mother. So I learned to stop my mind, stop my mouth. Sometimes I was not always successful, and just let my mother lead in the dance. Let her decide which way we were going and what the steps were.
That's true. What applies to dancing is that it's the man's job to make the woman look good. And of course, the man can't make the woman look good if the woman doesn't give him a chance to make her look good. My ballroom instructor, Mom, always have something special to say. She said that dancing with heart and passion creates a lifetime of bliss in a 3.5-minute song.
Yeah. You're so right. Bliss within you and bliss for your audience. Because, you know, in many of those things, you're telling a story, and that's what you're doing when you're caregiving. You're writing a new story. You're living a new story. Yeah, I mean, we could talk about ballroom dancing for the rest of our lives. Johnny, I'm tangoing with you on the phone.
There you go. I like that. I like that.
T-A-N-G-O.
That's right. Your mom passed away in 2006. Your book has been out for about 3 years now. Do you feel any sense of a cultural shift in people's opinion about dementia, those with the disease as well as those caring for them?
You know something, that's a very timely question, because I think so. I'm pretty, you know, well hooked into the Alzheimer's community globally, and by that I mean I hear about what's going on. My book first came out, I was invited to launch the books and do a performance based on the text, the theatrical performance or theatrical reading at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, because they have a huge Alzheimer's program there. They're the first ones to do it, actually, so many museums are doing that. And I bring that up because they were, as an evidence that the world is changing. Museums are interested in people with Alzheimer's. People with Alzheimer's are now spearheading committees and proposing policies and changes to legislation and to caregiving all over the world, and taking an active role in it themselves. And so I do feel that there's a shift to reinstituting self-respect and sort of personhood for the way people are cared for and the way they're treated. I think that's become very much a global initiative.
Right, very true.
Yeah.
The good news is that ballroom dancing actually is the best form of exercise for Alzheimer's patients, because it generates new neurons in your brain.
Yes. That's a really neat thing you're bringing up, because, it's very true. There's been studies on it. And, of course, what could be better than moving to music? Doesn't matter where your brain is. You're going to pick up rhythm and tune for sure.
Yeah. When I talk about body, we're not talking about muscles here. No, normal conventional muscles, because you're actually working your brain. You're working your cognitive ability to move your body. And so everything is moving in unison. And they find that ballroom dancing truly helps the seniors develop that total body action and exercise program.
Yes, I agree, and it's of course, as you know, such a beautiful experience.
Yeah. What would you like for your readers to gain from reading The Long Hello?
Well, I think that generally speaking, I would say go on the journey if you can. Go on it. It's doable. It's very tough. And, you know, there's lots of suffering. But if you pay attention and listen and be open and follow, not lead, that there are the experience is full of wondrous possibilities for meaning in that experience. We all know about meaning in darkness, and for added love. And I think that the other main thing I'd like people to gain is, because the book is written in the context of my life stories and my mom's life stories, as much as I could do that, that every caregiving experience is set within the context of both people's lives and all the stories that make up their lives. So that I think when you see it in that context, it makes everything more meaningful and easier to go through.
Precisely. You have some wonderful conversations back and forth, which is quite interesting because there's nothing added to it nor taken away. It's direct, simplistic conversations. That's what an Alzheimer's patient would have with their caregiver, just directly to the point. Yeah, which was very, very interesting. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Oh, well, I think probably, Johnny, the best place is my website, which is kathiebori.com. That's kathiebori.com. I think pretty well I've got everything covered there because I have my books, my audiobooks, plus I do performance pieces based on the text with either solo or with a cellist and an actor and even a gospel choir, Johnny, we've done. So, yeah, because it lends itself to so much beauty, my mom's words. So I would say that, and also online, you know, the usual Amazon, Barnes & Noble, et cetera. I think my website's the best place.
Wonderful. What advice can you offer individuals who are newly diagnosed with dementia?
Well, coming back to your excellent question about sort of a global shift, I think the best idea is to be, if you want to be, is to join groups and that represent your interests, like Alzheimer's associations and caregiving groups. Get all the information you can and be active in what's going on around you and how you're going to be cared for, and not to let anyone dismiss your experience, your presence and your needs. I would say stay fairly active in an advocacy role if you want to, and find out what's going on, be part of the change.
Interesting. What words of wisdom can you give to individuals who decided to become caregivers?
I think I can do that in one word: follow. Follow, follow, follow. Let go of self and ego. Follow the dance. Follow the person with the disease.
Yeah. Well, that's true. And what I notice also in your book is the patience, the love.
That's right. It's all about love, isn't it, Johnny? Everything is.
Yeah. And that's fascinating because when you look at that, it opens up a totally new avenue. And, of course, being present in the present moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How has writing The Long Hello impacted you personally?
Well, I think in the most positive vein, it made me a writer. I wouldn't have ever written this book or any book if it hadn't been for my mom's experience. And writing that book has then led to me doing performance pieces based on the text, which I never would have done before and always wanted to do performances. I love doing that. I've even incorporated dance into some of my performances. I forgot to tell you that. And and that gives me a great deal of pleasure. So I'm still very involved in this whole book, and it keeps going.
Yeah.
We're doing a stage play. It's just changed my life that way. That's my major focus now.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So what's next for you?
Well, more writing. I'm co-writing the play with a playwright here in Vancouver, so I'm not going to act in it, but that writing. I'm doing some poetry. I'm doing some projects with other people. Mostly, I would say, more writing. That's my hope.
Wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour.
Okay.
Would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Well, it's very simple, Johnny. What I was thinking about that about this morning, I was thinking about what is meaningful to me. Two things, if we have time. The first thing is I really try to focus on kindness. I try to think I'm giving myself a prescription every day to try to be kind. I love that phrase, and I've forgotten who said it, but be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. And I think that's true. So I do something as simple as when I walk down the street, I try to say hello to everybody I pass, especially people who are on their own, I mean. I try to say hello to connect with people, and I'm assuming they have tricky lives and maybe they're lonely. So that's one of my major recipes for living. And then I try to get up every morning and have this little personal ritual where I sort of try to invoke energy from the world to be a better person that day and to take in the beauty of the earth and then give it back out. I hope that doesn't sound too esoteric, but those are my two recipes.
No,
I like
not
to keep
at
it
all.
Simple. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think the years of spending with your mom, has that helped you in terms of formulating that recipe for living, in terms of paying attention to the present moment?
Yes, I think so. I'm very, very aware of time passing and that I have no idea what I have left, and I'm very aware that there's a lot of suffering and I need to pay attention to being kind as often as I can. And I think was made more aware of that by my mother's difficult yet marvelous journey.
Wonderful. Well, Kathy, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Amy Newmark. She is the publisher and editor-in-chief for Chicken Soup for the Soul. In celebrating the spirit of Thanksgiving, Amy and I will be sharing all the things we are thankful for this year. We will also be discussing Chicken Soup's latest edition, 101 Joyful Stories About Love, Fun, and Wonder of the Holidays. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Kathy, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again and have a blessed week.
Thank you so much, Johnny. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.